The following audio is from Park Church in Denver, Colorado. More information about Park Church is available online at parkchurchdenver.org.
Thank you guys for being here and taking time out of your weekend. I would probably say the same thing that has, you know, been said several times is, you know, to really love and care for somebody, it takes learning about them and understanding them and hearing their stories, and that's how we have empathy, right? Is when we can sort of understand and sort of try to put ourselves in someone else's story. So I'm going to start with my story too. See, there we go. So yes, it's me. So the year was 1968, and to give you some context for that, that was actually one of the worst years in like the 1900s in U.S. history, because our country was dealing with race riots and the assassination of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and Vietnam was going on. So I was 5 years old when that was going on. 1968, I was five. So as if my parents didn't have enough on their plate going on just culturally, this is about the time that I started really struggling in my gender. And it started off with, you know, just sort of small ways, like mimicking sort of feminine hand gestures and mannerisms. And these are like parents that grew up in the 50s that, you know, pretty conservative, like small gender roles. So weren't really figuring out how to deal with their young son that was doing this. Over time, these would become more pronounced, and I'm going to share a little bit more on another slide about that a little bit later, but there's like a classic story that just sort of illustrates the ways I was disidentifying as a boy. So it was 1970, and that's actually about the time this picture was taken. Christmas morning. So my brother and I come down, and what's underneath the tree? Two football uniforms. I was horrified. Absolutely horrified. I was so horrified that I lost my microphone. So out comes the home movie camera, and these were like those old, scratchy, faded home movies that were our fond memories, and now they're used for horror pictures and scary movies, but they were our fond memories. So it's really interesting for me to watch those home movies right now, because you can just sort of see my reaction to having this football uniform on. My brother is running around, he's excited, this is awesome, he's ready to toss the football around, and I'm like literally like sort of laying on the ground like I have a 100-pound weight on me. Like you could just tell, like, I didn't want this thing on me. And my dad's trying to get, like, there's no sound. You can tell him, like, do something, you know, and I'm just sort of trying to pass the football, you know, just not having it. So, I would just continue to sort of disidentify in a lot of ways with my gender. This other really awful picture, because it wasn't taken with an iPhone. Thank God we have iPhones now. The next Christmas in 1971, I got my own popcorn popper. So this is where I start saying that I started getting small household appliances for Christmas. My parents wised up, right? So I love popcorn. So what was going on? Let's start maybe with some definitions. I like this little genderbread person illustration. It's been on the internet for a long time. Maybe you've seen this. Even though it's been around for a long time, I just think it's just a really awesome little graphic that sort of describes things. And the artist is Sam Killerman, which I'm like, is that your real last name? Killerman. I don't know. It's sort of... So, you know, biological identity, that's our bodies, that's our anatomy, that's our sexual organs. That's a male and female. We sort of use those words. It's biology. It's our chromosomes, XX chromosomes, XY chromosomes. Then we have our gender identity. That's the little brain part up there. This is more like a social definition. This would be more like I would use more like words like more like masculinity, femininity. Do I fit? This is sort of my perception. Do I sort of fit in the world of men or women? Do I fit the gender roles and stereotypes that our culture is saying? Do I want to? Do I want to conform to those stereotypes? Do I want to rebel against those stereotypes? How am I fitting? You know, do I have what it takes to sort of fit in with men or women? So that's more like sort of here. The expression part, the little line all around the little person, this is sort of how we present, how we express our gender. This is hairstyles, clothing, activities that we do, that we're sort of gravitating to. And that's sort of where we, like I said, we get sort of hung up, because the way we're sort of expressing our gender, is that conforming to our culture, our families, our Christian culture? Is it not? Is it sort of going against that? So, and we're all navigating all of those. Everyone in this room is navigating your biology, your gender, sense of gender identity, and how you're expressing that, right? So, for better or worse, we're all, once again, leveling the playing field on that. So, gender dysphoria, that definition by Mark Yarhouse up there, is the experience of distress related to having a psychological and emotional gender identity that doesn't match your biological identity. And I really want to kind of cue on that word distress. This is like Elodie sort of mentioned that last night. She had that anxiety, and it sort of helped her to wear those Brooks Brothers clothes, which I'm sure you looked amazing in. So distress, is that persistent? Is it consistent? Is it growing? Is it getting more and worse? And I'm not just sort of talking uncomfortability. I'm talking about, is self-injury happening? I mean, is it getting like so awful? We'll sort of talk about, actually, I do have, I feel like I have to point that on the screen. So talking about that distress. So actually, the diagnosis of gender dysphoria is actually really rare. And want to make sort of a distinction between those two things. So this quote from Mark Yarhouse again, I think, really says, we can distinguish experiences of gender dysphoria from the diagnosis of gender dysphoria. When mental health professionals consider a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, they are saying that this unhappiness with one's given gender has risen to the level of personal distress or impairment beyond functioning in important areas like work or school. So you are actually, once it gets diagnosable, is when it is so bad that you are, I can't even function. And then some sort of intervention might be needed. There's a whole spectrum and controversy around intervention that we can talk about if you have questions. So back to my experience, if we use that little genderbread person model again, sort of what was going on, you know, at every stage of sort of development, I've done this talk where I've actually gone all the way into like adulthood with what was going on in all these areas, but luckily you don't have to hear that today. I'm just going to sort of take this one snapshot. But now, usually around 3 to 5 years old is when we become aware of gender. Like the little boy's like, hey, mommy doesn't have what we have. You know, they start becoming aware, like, there's differences, and I don't have that, and you have this. And so that happens about 3 to 5, and that's a lot of times where the dysphoria, for the most part, is going to sort of show up. Not always. It can happen in adolescence. It can even happen into adulthood. But so what was sort of going on with me sort of biologically, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm not a super tall person. I was usually, you know, like in the olden days when they had like picture day, they would like put you like in order, and I was always like first or second, you know. So I was like this little sort of petite little boy, sort of slight stature. I was really emotionally sensitive. I was a lot more emotional, I was really different than my younger brother. I was, at an early age, I was, you could already tell that I was not at home in my body. I had this modesty that was, for 5 years old, was just not good. I was like sort of overly modest at a really young age. You could tell I just wasn't even comfortable in my body already then. And I wasn't like a rough and tumble kid. I was just this really different kid. I was artistic, I was emotional, and my parents just sort of didn't know how to deal. But they knew how to sort of deal with my rough and tumble sports-oriented brother, but they just sort of didn't know what to do with me. As far as gender identity, there were times when I was wishing I was a girl. And there was always times when I was always identifying sort of with the girl. Like if I'm watching a television show, I was always sort of looking at her like, how, what is she doing? How is she reacting? I was sort of identifying with that person. And then there was this sort of growing contempt as I was getting older for men. Like, I don't know what that is, but I don't want to grow up and be whatever that is. If I can do whatever I can to not grow up to be that. It was sort of like all the most awful negative things about men that I was just sort of being highlighted for me. So the way I was sort of expressing that was play the girls' parts in play. So if we played house, guess who was the mom? Right? If we played Gilligan's Island, who was Marianne or Ginger? It was always funner to be Ginger because she always got what she wanted all the time. I don't know if you ever saw that on the show. Ginger always got what she wanted most of the time. Also dressed in girls' clothes, like my brother and I got babysat by a woman next door. She had this huge playroom with toys and a big box of clothes, and of course it's dresses and heels, and every day, who do you think's dressing up in those clothes? This was like second, third grade. My parents found out about that, and boy, did I get a good shaming and a bawling out for that, and never did that again. It's a lot of shame. Speaking of shame, I was mistaken for a girl a lot of times. You know, it was the 70s, so I had sort of one of those Beatles bangs haircut kind of thing, and glasses. I started getting glasses, and you know, at that age, I had like the highest pitched scream in the neighborhood too, which is awesome. So, sorry. I'm sort of laughing about that, but it was actually really awful because my parents, they would be, is this your daughter? Or my brother, is this your sister? And I could see, I would feel actually the waves of shame that they would feel, the embarrassment that they felt about that. And so also drawn to toys and games that were, I was sort of one of those boys, like, I love dinosaurs, like a little boy that loved dinosaurs, which I think is awesome. Like, every time I see a little boy that loves dinosaurs, I'm like, I love that. Legos and Matchbox cars and Hot Wheels. Remember those orange tracks? Like, we'd slap each other with them or have sword fights. But I also was like, I thought my cousin's Barbies were awesome, and she had that three-story, like, penthouse thing with elevator. I was, like, fascinated. Loved changing Barbie's clothes. I wanted an easy bake oven, jump rope champion on the playground, not doing a lot with my male peers. That wasn't really helping me a lot. So just drawn to things that were culturally more feminine, and that set me up for a lot of problems at school and at home. Boys were just sort of mysterious to me, like, I just sort of hung with the girls. All the boys were sort of out there. And I was always sort of like, they seem sort of mysterious. Like, why are they always spitting? And do I need to spit? Like, I just never got, like, why are you always spitting all the time? So, you know, I felt different. And, you know, as I said, I was always detaching from symbols like clothing, like the football uniform story. And as I would get older, like, I would not wear a suit. I started disidentifying, like, I will not wear anything that would sort of be this symbol of sort of awful masculinity to me. So we're going to take sort of a little side trip here. So we're going to talk just about sort of really quickly about the transgender issue. So who's under the transgender umbrella? I don't really know who actually did this. I can never find who actually did this illustration, but the first thing about the transgender umbrella is no one can agree who's under it. If you talk to certain people, they will say certain people are, certain people aren't. A lot of fighting under the transgender umbrella. So, but I'm going to start with, if you sort of look way up in that corner, that, what is that, right-hand corner, the word cisgender, that's outside the transgender umbrella. So usually I just say, if you don't know what the word cisgender means, you probably are, sort of the joke. Because all that means is that you're not transgender. This, your gender identity is matching your body. And that's like most of the world. So everything under the transgender umbrella would be people that are not sort of conforming or living in ways where this is matching. So there's that little piece up there, drag kings and drag queens. So these are people that cross-dress for entertainment. And I have some drag queen friends. I have some really interesting friends. But they would not put themselves, I don't think they would necessarily put themselves under this umbrella. So, but they cross-dress for entertainment. There's also cross-dressers sort of right below that. These are people that cross-dress for arousal. And a definition of that would be a young adolescent or adult male who is sexually aroused by the fantasy of being a woman or behaving like a woman or sometimes fantasizing about having female body parts. And at adolescence, fetish behavior cross-dressing, wearing female clothing, typically lingerie, looking in the mirror and masturbating. So they dress for arousal. This eventually, I have a lot of friends that sort of, people that sort of navigate this a lot differently. I have friends that would see this as an addiction, and it's something they fight against. I have other people that would consider themselves to be transgender, and they would eventually be moving into wanting surgery and to become like full surgical female. So people navigate that a lot differently. There are some other words up here like that agendered on the end. That means just someone that feels like, I don't really feel like I'm either gender. I'm agender. I'm not male, I'm not female. There's other words up there like two-spirit, bi-gender, or third gender, and that means somebody that would be like, I sort of feel like I'm both genders or a blend of genders or I'm sort of in between genders. So that gets sort of confusing. Intersex, right up there, sort of up there be above that. Intersex is actually an umbrella term that means to describe a condition in which a person is born with sex characteristics or anatomy that does not allow them to identify clearly as male or female. Sometimes this, this could be ambiguous genitalia. This could be internal or external sort of issues with ovaries or testes. This can also be chromosomal, like a very common one is a woman that would have an XY chromosome. And there's sort of a spectrum of how many different conditions this can sort of cover. On the minimum side, that's probably 0.001% of the population. On a higher side, I've seen numbers of 0.02 to 1.7% of the population. On that higher side, that would say about 50,000 people in the U.S. deal with intersex conditions. So that's a biological issue. So you should remember when we're thinking about the transgender umbrella that a lot of people don't feel distress about these things. They're not seeking treatment. They would not necessarily fit in that dysphoric category. So sort of back to my story a little bit. So this is Mark Yarhouse's, what are some symptoms of childhood dysphoria? I'll just read some of them. A strong desire to be or an insistent that one is the other gender. This is like small children. In boys, a strong preference for cross-dressing or simulating female attire. In girls, a strong preference for wearing typical masculine clothing and a strong resistance to wearing typical female clothing. A strong preference for cross-gender roles in make-believe play or fantasy. A strong preference for the toys, games, or activities stereotypically used or engaged in by the other gender. A strong preference by the playmates for the playmates of the other gender. And then in boys, the strong rejection of typically masculine toys, games, and activities, and strong avoidance of rough and tumble play. And for girls, the same thing. So I was reading these on a plane. I was reading Mark Yarhouse's book. I almost yelled out to everybody on the plane, like, it's official, everybody. I have all six of these growing up, right? Luckily, I didn't. But the other two, there's actually eight. The other two are, this actually happens more in adolescence, is where a strong dislike of one's anatomy, like, oh, no, I'm hitting puberty, I'm turning into something I don't want. And for women, that's like breasts and menstrual cycle. That's where sort of that distress starts happening, or a strong desire for the primary or secondary characteristics that match one's experienced gender. So those happen more typically in adolescence. So having all six of those, I would say, like, I don't know if you can tell, but I haven't transitioned to full female. Can you tell that? Okay, it was a joke. It was a bad one. But remember I talked about the difference between sort of gender dysphoric experiences and the actual diagnosis. So actually, Elodie sort of brought this up last night. Is it persisting or is it desisting? And actually, 75 to 80% will actually, who have these dysphoric kids that have this dysphoria, will actually just sort of naturally grow into their gender. I've heard that a higher number, I just saw this with some other PhD on a panel, some professionals that were talking, 85 to 90%, that's a little bit higher. I guess some of the things I could say was, for me, obviously I didn't have that growing distress. That wasn't happening. Another thing that influenced, I think, was as I grew into adolescence and puberty, my orientation stories took over. Like, oh, I'm starting experiencing attractions to both men and, you know, to girls and boys, and that was, you know, really confusing. So my gender story sort of took a back seat as I was sort of figuring out, like, uh-oh, what's happening with my attractions? And then I think as I got older, I have a whole sort of complicated story of becoming a Christian, leaving Christianity, going into the gay community, coming out, and I just sort of decided, I guess I could just be an effeminate gay man. I don't have to transition. I can just be an effeminate gay man. And then I start realizing that gay men aren't attracted to feminine gay men. So that was a bummer. Yeah, that I wouldn't say coming out really helped my body issues or my gender identity very much, I like to always say. But, you know, eventually I would have to deal with my, I started having to deal with my gender issues in my 20s. And I started doing that at Where Grace Bounds, where I really had to really look at those issues around my gender. Part of it was just like sort of the sad realization, like, you're a boy, you're a guy. And I'm like, oh, crap. I guess I am. So, but there was a lot of having to deal with those symbols, the symbols that I had made about masculinity. There was just a lot of work that I had to sort of uncover, vows I had made, lies I believed, things like that. So I think there's two things I'm just going to say, two disturbing trends that are affecting this number, the 75 to 80% of kids that will just naturally grow. I think there's two disturbing trends, in my opinion, that are affecting this. One is it's trendy. There's a real cultural trend to be trans right now, especially in adolescent girls, where... Well, it even has a diagnosis. Remember, like in the 90s, it was really cool to be bi, and then in the 2000s, it was really cool to be pansexual, and now it's just really cool to be trans. So, two doctors, Dr. J. Michael Bailey and Dr. Ray Blanchard, would describe this. This is an actual diagnosis, and we're getting more calls about this, and we're just seeing a real prevalence of this. So, the adolescent female acquires the conviction that she is transgender. Not uncommonly, others in her peer group acquire the same conviction. These peer groups encourage each other to believe that all unhappiness, anxiety, and life problems are likely due to their being transgender. And that gender transition is the only solution. Subsequently, there may be a rush towards gender transition, including hormones. Parental opposition to gender transition often leads to family discord. Even estrangement and suicidal threats are common. So that's the thing that's happening. We're getting more phone calls where suddenly people's teenagers, mostly girls, some a little bit more less percentage with boys, are saying, coming to their parents and saying, I'm transgender. We also have a culture, this is the second thing that I think is threatening this number, where large parts of academic, medical, and psychological communities are offering a one-size-fits-all, no-questions-asked treatment ideology that rushes these small children, adolescents, to transition them using hormones and puberty blockers, when more than likely they are not transgender. And there's a lot of consequences to puberty blockers and to hormones that leaves lasting damage. I'll just say that. So what's really refreshing is this is not a progressive or a conservative or a right or a left issue. There are academic, psychological, and medical professional people on both sides that are disturbed by this sort of one-size-fits-all treatment ideology and rushing these kids to transition. So as Elodie said last night, if I were living in today's culture, I'd probably be transitioned right now. And I just want to say this just came up last week. I don't know if you saw on the news, but it was a Hamilton County, Ohio judge on last week gave custody of a transgender teen to his grandparents, allowing them to make medical decisions regarding his transition. I think this is, we're talking like a 16 or 17-year-old, and it was due to their Christian beliefs. So that's a big deal. That's saying a lot that's going on in our culture right now. So I'll just sort of end real quickly with just sort of a truth and grace response to this issue. I think it's really important to sort of hold, like Elodie and Raj, we've been talking, to really hold on to the sacredness of gender, to really hold on to the sacredness of male and female and sexuality and scripture. I think to hold on to that is valuable. I think things like the transgender population or the intersex population makes us wrestle with that male and female, and we have to wrestle with that reality. But it's okay to hold on. We don't have to throw it all out just because of these people. And I don't think, one thing I think too that I see is just because those are small portions, like 50,000 people, these are still people. We actually still need to care about them. We don't just blow them off because they're a small percentage of the population. But just to highlight those things that God is the creator. He has original purpose, design, intent for gender and sexuality. Elodie talked about that. I know Gary's probably going to wrap us up with that. God created us male and female in his image, and it was good. It was a good thing. He created us to enjoy our gender, which has not always been my story, but I am more these days. And our gender and sexuality are incarnational pictures of the Trinity and God's relationship with his creation. Our gender, made in the image of God, and our sexuality is a picture, a visible picture of the invisible Trinity. And that's why I'm making decisions about my sexuality. That's probably the main thing right there. Because, you know, at the end of the day, it's not about what I think or feel or how I perceive myself. Those are important things. But the fact that they're tied to bigger spiritual realities is why I'm making those choices about my sexuality. And then we live in a fallen world, and we don't know the extent of how this has affected our gender and sexuality. We just don't know the extent that this has affected. And God is in the business of redeeming all of our lives, but we don't really know what that looks like for each person, right? Like Raj said, perhaps your gender or sexuality issues aren't on God's first list to work on. And so a grace approach, keeping all that in mind. Pastoral care, this is a really painful issue with the families that we work with, the people that I know. So pastoral care for hurting people and hurting families. There is a mystery to God created in his image. There is a mystery in our gender because of that. We don't know about God and being in his image. We don't know everything about gender. So humble approach is always good. There are way more smarter people with more letters behind their name who sit with more transgender people that know a lot more about me than at the end of the day say, I just don't know. And so the fact that they don't know, I just think that's a good thing for all of us to sort of enter that with a real humble posture and position. So what families need is they really need a lot of support. Because, and I say for the long haul, because you know what? If you're dealing with a kid or a small child or an adolescent or a parent that's transitioning, this is probably going to be a really long, painful thing. It's not going to just magically sort of... So they need a lot of support. And we've been walking with people for decades through their issues, right? So they also need help with family relationships in order. You know, we were at a conference this summer with Bill Henson, with the organization of Lead Them Home, and we talked about statistics. And one of the largest factors for an LGBTQ teen factors for suicide attempts or ideation is the family rejecting them and then bullying. And we've talked about some of those things just in our own stories, you know. Those are huge things. So family helping a family navigate those issues is really important. And then helping them navigate their personal faith. The bigger thing that we've been saying is, you know what the bigger truth is that God loves them, and they often don't hear that bigger truth. They hear all this other truth from us, but not that God actually loves them. And then just help with mental issues and coping strategies. It's really important, as you can see from the treatment things that I just talked about, that it's important to find a good therapist, to really be praying that someone that matches your convictions, that can deal with. There's a lot of mental health issues around, not just the family relationships and the bullying and the shame, but mental health issues like depression, anxiety. There's just a lot of things to deal with. So finding some good, and I put that statistic up that 40 to 41% of mostly adult trans males will attempt suicide or think about it. That population has a very high suicide rate. And then dignity just for the person and the family. You know, we had a speaker that came to our group the other night, and we were talking about gender, and we were sort of talking about our bodies as being gendered people. And he said something I just thought really stuck with me. He said, you know, for the most part, we are either attacked or excluded, mostly because of our bodies, like you're too fat, you're too thin, or you just don't fit sort of the beautiful body. Or you're attacked because you don't fit gender-wise, or you're excluded because you're not fitting in with what's conforming. I thought that was really profound. I'm just going to sort of end with this story. There's a gentleman that's transitioning to a woman. He's an older person, so a male to female transgender person that I've been meeting with. And, you know, really sadly, this person doesn't pass as a woman. You know, he's like this tall, hands this big. And I've probably met with her for about 3 or 4 times, not a Christian. And I just said, what is it life like for you as you're just moving about in your world every day? And just the story of rejection. People won't sit next to her on the bus. And she actually has this amazing attitude that is probably better than most Christians even. She says, you know, you don't have to respect my choices. You don't have to respect my lifestyle, but don't disrespect me as a person. And I just thought, wow, that's very sort of gracious that you give people sort of options so that they don't have to sort of like, but to have a boundary that I'm not going to be disrespected. So I just think that a little bit of kindness, like I can hold on to my truth, what I believe about scripture, what I believe about male and female, but I don't have to get in someone's face and insist that I'm right about it, or that I have to win the debate. And it's amazing how a little bit of kindness just goes a long way. The fact that I'm meeting with this person and just sort of letting her be where she's at, I can tell just is because she doesn't get treated that way very much. So, yeah, a little bit of kindness goes a long way. And yesterday was the first time, I just met with her yesterday, that I actually got to ask just a little bit about a faith journey. Because she mentioned something, I had that opportunity, because she talked about like why I don't believe in God. And I was like, I would really love to hear that story. And so I just thought, wow, I offered some resources. Like if you ever do feel like you want to pursue something spiritual, I have some safe spaces that I think I can offer you. I don't know where that's going to go, but, you know, we've been sort of talking about how to sort of engage people like that. And I just thought, waited for this sort of opportune time. I've built the trust. And I really do have an affection for this person that I really enjoy getting together with her. And I think it's been interesting journeying with somebody like that. So that's all I have to sort of share.
Thank you, Scott. If we can get that slide, great.
Yeah.
Any more questions you guys have, go ahead and text them in.
Oh, yeah.
And we will get rolling. First question. Comes off.
This feels like more intimidating. Like I could just talk and then like sort of go and have lunch. And okay.
And we kind of sprung the Q&A on you. Not really. So I noticed even with this biological male who's transitioned, you know, through surgery or is in transition, you've changed the pronoun, now referring to what was a him as a her, which opens up to me, and one of the questions came through, what do we do with this whole realm of pronouns? You're talking about 100% grace and 100% truth. It's almost like we're forced to pick which side we're going to lean on,
right,
based upon the pronouns that we're going to choose. How do you navigate that?
Well, you know, I used to be a lot more rigid about that. And that's when I really didn't know anybody personally. Well, actually, I guess I did. We did know somebody in our ministry that was a woman that had lived and transitioned and lived for a while as a man. And I used to just be like, I'm not going to, you know, sort of buy into that. I guess I just sort of think that it really depends on the relationship with the person, first of all. So if I just think if this is somebody that, I just think it's respectful, like say with this person that I'm meeting with, I want to engage their life. I want to be respectful. She actually always gives the option, you can just call me by my name. You don't even have to use a pronoun if you don't want to, which I think is also really gracious. So I just think that if I want to care for this person, I'm going to be respectful and use that pronoun for them. Now, on the other hand, like I said, it has to do with the level of a relationship. If you're a parent whose child is transitioning, that might be really hard for you to use a different name. And I just want to sort of offer the space to sort of have to have that not be okay, to really wrestle with that. The person that I meet with, she says, my kids still call me dad. I'm their father. So she allows that to happen. But on some level, it is sad that you would lose your father, right? There's a sadness there. So I just sort of say, generally, I would generally just be respectful and sort of use that depending on the relationship. I might have a friend that's transitioning, that still might be hard. And I might just say to that friend, I might just need some time to just, I might just not be comfortable with that. And I hope that's okay. I want to support you. I want to be kind, but is it okay if I have space to sort of work that out? I just think offering, it's okay to have space to work that out if it's a close relationship. If it's someone that I just sort of generally see, like, you know, a transgender server at a restaurant or something, I will just be kind and use their pronoun. So is that?
Yeah. So you're saying you lean very much on the side, let's not sabotage the relationship before it begins.
Right.
Or in the midst of it. And actually have a chance to communicate what's true eventually. Like it seems like you're starting to get a foot in the door a little bit.
Yeah. I also just want to sort of say that I think it's really interesting because how gay men just call each other girl all the time. I mean, I just don't know the I even asked my friends, tell me about the psychological thing behind that, you know. Like, hey girl, you know, blah, blah, and we call each other girl, and I just think it's sort of campy and funny, but so I just want to sort of say that's it. And another thing about pronouns, too, is there's the pronoun they and them. There are people that want to be known as they and them, and I think that's, you know, I don't want to use a she or a he pronoun. I want to go as they or them. I think that's also sort of hard, especially if you are just really a grammar person. That's just not good grammar. Right, Jill? Jill and Steve are our family and friends people on our staff, and they have a daughter that has someone that's navigating that, and I just know Jill has, she's just like, it's just not good grammar. So I just say sort of, those are some other pronoun things too.
Related question. I'm a pediatrician. How would you advise me to counsel patients with gender dysphoria? A biological teen female who identifies as a male has such anxiety that they do not attend school or function. How do I navigate gender names, pronouns, mental health, treatment, etc.?
So it was a teen from male to female, or female to male?
A biological female who identifies as male.
As male. As a pediatrician. Well, it sounds like the dysphoria is really high. I mean, it's really high. I would probably, and I, you know, I'm not a doctor or even like some really super expert on this either, but I would probably do things that would help that anxiety. And I think, like I said, finding a therapist, finding some mental health for that family and for that child that is going to give them space, deal with the, because that sort of gets into ideas about sort of what you can do. Mark Yarhouse has a couple different ways that you can navigate a dysphoric child. Like, will I sort of encourage them to, is there a space that I can encourage them in things in their gender? Is there a space, is that child sort of there? And I have a story that I have sort of about my own childhood is, I hated the football uniform, but I was really into Charlie Brown. So for some reason, I was wearing a baseball hat and carrying a mitt around for a while. It's so weird. And my dad was actually sort of, took about 5 seconds and was actually teaching me how to sort of throw a fastball. And of course, I was throwing it like a girl. Wasn't very good at that yet, but which is so insulting, right? Throwing like a girl. Sorry, ladies. I think that's insulting, actually. But I just thought if there could have been some work that I could have, he could have done, I might have been open to something that would have maybe more encouraged me in my gender a little bit more. So there is that thing. Now, there, like I said, that's a controversy because there are people who would say, you're trying to convert that child. You know, more progressive people would say, that's a bad thing. There's also this watchful waiting where you just sort of wait and sort of see what the child is doing. And then if the dysphoria is sort of really high, I've worked with some families where it, that exact situation has happened where the anxiety is so high, like there was self-injury happening, the child, you know, the adolescent was doing that, where they started, they decided to, let's do some reversible things, like with Elodie's clothes. Like, here's some clothes. Clothing, cut your hair, change your name, use a different pronoun. All of that's reversible so that if you can give the child some space. What's so wrong about sort of this treatment ideology is let's just put him, rush him into transition as opposed to let's give this kid some space because who knew who you were when you were 13 or 14 or 6 or 54 or, you know. So give them some space to sort of see, you know, and those are reversible things that you can do. And I would just say stay with the reversible things as long as possible because, like I said, once you start getting the hormones and puberty blockers and there's just a lot of consequences to those things, yeah.
Your Charlie Brown example hits on something that I've had a number of conversations with people in Park recently, and that's the kind of the stereotypes around gender. Of, you know, even the example, which makes sense culturally, but that it exists, of saying, well, I was doing something sports-related, so I was kind of matching my biology with, mm-hmm. with the kind of the social construction of gender.
Right.
And yet, many of these things emerge not from Scripture. I mean, who's to say that a little girl doesn't want to do the same thing, and we're not going to say, well, that doesn't fit your gender. How do we make sense of that? Because we want to say, yes, you know, God's good design is binary. Male and female. Mm-hmm. And there's brokenness that's found its way into that, and we want to see the binary reality of that expressed culturally in our own homes with our own kids, you know, family members, whoever else. But so often we have these concrete buckets of this is what it has to look like, this versus this. How do we make sense of that terrain?
Well, I would agree that American culture isn't sort of the end-all, be-all answer to male and female. You know, one thing I think that sort of helped me start navigating some of my own gender issues and other people that I know is to sort of make most, well, the reality is most everything is gender neutral for the most part. There are men that cook, there are men, women that cook, there are women that play sports. Most of the things that we do are really for the most part neutral. And that sort of helped me sort of get over the fact that I had to be something. A lot of our marketing right now, I think, is sort of problematic, too. Like, I had a mom say, oh, I knew my son was gay because he was playing with My Little Pony. And I said, well, first of all, I don't think playing with My Little Pony means who you're sexually attracted to. That doesn't really make sense, right? That's more like a gender issue. And really, it's more of a marketing issue. Because if My Little Pony wasn't marketed to girls, then who would care? You know, so all of our stuff, there's such a hyper-marketing thing with the pink and the blue and the marketing that really is sort of problematic in our culture, too. But for the most part, I just think most things are gender neutral and it's sort of encourage your kid. I just read another article where there was this girl that was a tomboy. I sort of almost feel like that really resonated with your story, Elle, where they kept saying, everybody who's all professional is like, we need to start transitioning her because she's, you know, blah, blah. She's a tomboy. She just likes to play sports. And the parent is just saying, she's herself. I don't need to transition her. You know, she can enjoy sports. She can enjoy who she is without... So the parent's sort of trying to navigate, just letting the kid once again sort of have space to be who they are, you know? So...
What do we do with the bathrooms?
I wish we lived in Portland because they just have just separate bathrooms now for everything. But, well, the last I heard, there was 18 states that have passed sort of LGBT laws that sort of protect the bathroom rights. That's just such a hard thing. So that is sort of the reality that's happening. I sort of feel for both sides. I think that, first of all, I think it's become a symbol of acceptance for trans people. Like, if I can use the bathroom of my choice, this means I'm validated and I'm okay to be who I am. So the reason it's such a giant issue is because it's a symbol. So that's why that means something. So I know this is like sort of, and I don't know, that's where you start thinking statistically, like, is that true? Where people that aren't trans but want to sort of be voyeuristic can pretend they're trans and go into women's restrooms. I don't know what the statistics are and how that threatens people. Some statistics say that that's not really existing. Others say it's very high. We're sort of in a culture these days where you can find statistics to sort of match whatever you believe, which is sort of why I always use a spectrum. But I don't know. I just think if it wasn't a symbol, then, like, if I were trans, I'd just rather use my own bathroom. I would rather just right now use my own bathroom personally. But, so I don't know. I don't know if I have a clearer answer for that because I just sort of see the needs of both sides and can empathize with both sides and, yeah.
So again, drawn on your own story, how would you parent children well that may be experiencing a story similar to yours?
Well, you know what would have been like so awesome? This was the 70s, where I was sort of made to feel like my artistic temperament or something was like wrong with me because of that or because of my gender. You know, I just really sort of felt like my parents didn't really. And you know what's really true is my father died about 8 years ago, and he died of cancer. So we had a lot of time to talk about our lives. And there was a lot of reconciliation that happened even prior to that because my parents weren't even thrilled that I came out and we were really estranged for a long time. But my dad said something that finally, you know, when you hear that word that is so validating that you thought you were crazy for like 40 years of your life and then you finally hear like, oh, I wasn't crazy. Because my dad said, I knew I should have done something different with you. How I treated you and raised you and engaged with you, I should have done differently than I did with Kelly, my brother. So because my dad didn't know what to do with me, they just didn't do anything. So I was left on my own. I was sort of abandoned. So if he would have saw me and realized I was drawing all the time, and the story was I was drawing all the time and they put me in band. And I sucked. I was last chair in clarinet. Remember when we had last chair? Let's talk about shame. Oh my God. Mostly because I didn't want to practice the clarinet. I wanted to go home and watch the Brady Bunch. So I never practiced. So, but I was drawing and drawing and drawing, and they put me in band, and I was drawing and drawing and drawing, and they put me in Cub Scouts, which was even more problematic because a dysphoric kid in Cub Scouts, not a good combo. But if they just would have saw me and engaged my life and encouraged who I was and my temperament and my personality and my things, that would have probably helped about like 90%, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about the role of the church? So you talked about some of leaving Christianity for a while and then coming back, and also specifically the role of shame in that process.
What was the question? I'm sorry.
Will you just unpack the journey a little bit more?
Oh, so about my journey?
Yes, your journey in particular. So leaving the church, leaving Christianity, the shame that you felt, and then coming back. What was both the leaving and the returning like?
Well, I wasn't raised as a Christian. So if you would have asked my parents, they would be like, sure, we're American, we're Christian, we're not Buddhist, you know, we don't live in Japan. But we didn't go to church, and I didn't know who Jesus was. I only knew Jesus from the nativity story, you know. I would play with the nativity scene like it was a dollhouse. It was awesome. You know, so all sort of that pain of sort of growing up sort of alone and then having all these issues. I was already sexually involved at a really early age with a friend at 14, and that sort of solidified, oh, I guess you're gay, and they've been calling you this all the time, so I guess this is who you are. So I sort of stopped, because I was sort of genuinely attracted to girls, too, at that age, but I just, that sort of solidified my identity at a pretty early age, and I just said, I guess I'm gay. And that was all internal, because it was like 1970, and it's not like, hey, everyone, I'm gay, it's awesome, you know? There wasn't a million gay characters on TV. So for about 10 years, I was just navigating all that on my own, which I wouldn't recommend, actually. But so then I became a Christian, and it was awesome, and Jesus became very real to me, and I was suddenly like in youth groups, and I was learning about the Bible, but now I was hearing worse messages about homosexuality. And I'd already been, like, already engaged in that behavior, and I sort of had an early porn addiction. And so I just kept hearing all these messages, and I was struggling so much internally, and I was trying to just sort of shove everything down, like Elodie, like the white-knuckling thing, and trying to be this victorious Christian teen. And I lasted about a year and realized I just don't think there's a space for me here. So I left Christianity, came out, lived in the gay community, left the Lord. Every once in a while, I would drag my Bible out, and I'd look at those passages, and I'd get really freaked out, and I'd put my Bible. Or I'd, like, play my old Christian albums. Like, I saved a couple, and I'd cry, because I really did sort of was really confused about my life. And there was a lot about, like I said, being in the gay. I was obviously not a very functional person, getting involved with not very functional people and doing more damage relationally to myself. And I'm in bars and in clubs because that was the only place I felt safe. So I'm doing a lot of drugs. I'm numbing my pain with a lot of drugs and alcohol. And I came out in 85, and that's when AIDS hit the scene. So I was not sexually promiscuous. That was very scary because people were dying in about 5 seconds. And I remember just sort of meeting the first person with HIV. Like, suddenly this giant thing on the news is suddenly, like, once again sort of real. That was very scary. My life was sort of a shambles. I was thinking, I guess I just need like a therapist. And then I met this Christian man. And this could be just another example, sort of. I was working in a bank. He was really hot. So the Lord knew who to send to get my attention, which he did. So he had a little fish on his deposit slip with his wife's name on it too, and I was just like, ugh. He's a Christian. I know what he already thinks about me. So, but he was really kind. And of course, I was obviously like very attracted to him. I would be on the lookout for him all the time. Like that's when you had to actually go to the bank, you know, like I'd walk in a bank. So I sort of knew when he came in, so I'd always be on the lookout for him. And I'd always try to like, you know, shoving people like, I can help you down here. Sorry, little old lady, you know. And so he would come, and he was very kind. And I found out that he was a counselor, and I thought, one day he just sort of showed up at my window. I was having a really bad day, and it was unexpected. And he just said, would you like, he's like, are you doing okay? And I actually honestly said, I'm not. And he said, would you like to get together and talk sometime? And I did, actually. But I was really nervous. I shared my story with him, and I was sort of hoping he would validate my story. And he just said, sort of really simply just said, we probably have some differing views on what Scripture says about sexuality, but I would really like to get to know you. So I was sort of wrestling with this dichotomy because he insulted my whole personhood. I am gay. Every fiber of my being is gay. And the fact that you just sort of said that sort of invalidates my whole identity. So that's one side. The other side was, I just really would like to talk to him, and he wants to get to know me. And that meant a lot to me. So he just kept talking. We'd meet, and he tried to talk about the gay thing, and I'd be like, he's like, talk about his wife and his kids, and I'm like, that's awesome for you. I don't know what that has to do with me, but good for you. I was not really the best sort of disciple. I was just sort of sort of bitchy and sort of awful. Smoking my big old cigarette, you know. It was the 80s, my hair was this high. But he started talking about Jesus. He just kept talking about Jesus. And I kept saying, oh no, the Holy Spirit is convicting me, and I either need to get away from this person, or I need to really face who Jesus is. And I just remember sort of praying and saying, Lord, I don't know why your people have such a big cow about this, and I feel like I've felt like this for a long time, and I want to know what's really true about this, and I don't want to come just for a year if I'm going to come back to you. I want to come back forever. But I just am so confused about, I don't know what to do with this. So nothing magically happened except I was a closet Christian because I thought, you know, my boyfriend is not going to be real thrilled about my recent conversion to Christianity. Or that I'm putting this question back on the table of, is this okay or not? And my friends. So I was like reading my Bible secretly and sneaking off to church. And eventually I started telling, it didn't go over very well. And then eventually I found a friend of mine who had always talked about her Christianity being in conflict with that. I already sort of knew about a group like Where Grace Abounds. And she said, do you want to come to this group? And I'm like, are they going to hypnotize me or shock me or I don't know. But finally, I did, and it was so awesome because, like, sort of like Raj said and what Ellie says, I could sort of bring these worlds together. My gay friends obviously didn't know, like, God was really important to me, and I wasn't ready for church. Church was too scary. So Where Grace Abounds was sort of my church for a while, and eventually I sort of did make my way into the church, and it was one of those things, you know, I'm sure this is just anybody walking in church, like, I'd go sit in the back and flee at the end. And then God was saying, why don't you stay and have a donut? And I'm like, ugh, you know. And then having to like sort of go into the Christian men thing was really hard. But there were some men that really, I think, really loved me well in that. Made me feel like belonging. There was a place for me there. Yeah. Thank you. Sorry. No, I felt like I took a long time with that.
That's great. Just as we think about more recent, I mean, there are a lot of questions we haven't gotten to yet. What are some other resources you can point us to? I know you quoted Mark Yarhouse a couple of times. We'd love to hear some books you recommend of his. I know he has one specifically on gender dysphoria. Mm-hmm. So his book, and then what are some other resources you recommend as we try to move forward in this?
Oh, wow. There's Well, Mark Yaros has a lot on sexual identity and gender dysphoria. I was just talking with someone. There's a new book that just came out by Nate Collins that I thought was really awesome. I just read that. It's called All But Invisible. And it really is really more talking about this group of people that don't really necessarily want to identify as gay, or they might identify as a gay Christian, but some might not. But they're wanting to live out their convictions in more of that historic, traditional. And it just sort of encompasses and gives language about how to sort of care for that person, and gave me a lot of language just for my own experience. I thought it was really good. That just came out just recently that I think is a really awesome read. There's a couple books. I'm not as familiar with a lot of some of the other books on transgender from a Christian perspective, but I know if you, on our website, we have a lot of resources and stuff like that too, but if you want to talk more about resources, I'm glad to sort of sit and talk more personally, like for more what you're looking for in the situation. Yeah.
Yeah, I encourage you guys. We're going to go to break here in a second, but folks from Where Grace Abounds are going to be over at their table. Check out some of the articles they have. Ask them more questions. Utilize them. I mean, they're here in our city to serve us and to serve the church. So we want to make use of that. And then Meg, I saw Meg here. You here? She also works for Lead Them Home, and she has a plethora of ideas for resources as well.
Yes, so that's
bombard
awesome.
Her. Sorry, Meg.
Ministry, awesome.
They do great work. Some of us from staff went down to Denver Seminary a few months ago and heard them speak. Really well done. So, thank you, Scott, for being here.